This is the original introduction, the first paragraph of the introduction of the Age of Revolution, from 1789 to 1848 by Eric Hobsbawm. Words are witnesses which often speak louder than documents. Let us consider a few English words which were invented or gained modern meaning substantially in the period of the 60 years with which this volume deals. They are words such as industry, industrialist, factory, middle class, working class, capitalist, and socialism. They include aristocracy as well as railway, liberal and conservative as political terms, nationality, scientist and engineer, proletariat, and economic crisis. Utilitarianism and statistics, sociology, and several other names of modern sciences, journalism, and ideology are all coinages or adaptations of this period. So is strike and pauperism. Comrades and friends, hello. We are in the shadow of Rockford Tower. We're behind enemy lines. We're in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. And I'm excited for the conversation today because we're welcoming our old friend, the professor of American democracy, Harvey J.K. Harvey, hello.
Hello. And I got to tell you that, okay, so I read Hobsbawm's Age of Revolution a long, long time ago. And I will immodestly say that Eric and I became friends as a consequence of the work that I did on the British Marxist historians. I had him here in Green Bay to speak, and we had a great time on the weekend he was here. I mean, along the way, Hobsbawm actually tried to avoid me. Okay. Carl, what's your degree in? Your producer, what's his degree in?
Political science and computer science.
Okay, right, now I do remember you told me that once. But yeah, this is, I've got a whole bunch of things I just want to say since you've pointed to Eric Hobsbawm. So when I first contacted each of the British Marxist historians, I know that's not our subject today, but I got to tell the stories anyhow. It was E.P. Thompson, Christopher Hill, Rodney Hilton, and Eric Hobsbawm, as well as Maurice Dobb, who I didn't realize at the time actually was still alive, and I missed out on the opportunity to meet him. But I asked Eric if it would be possible, as I was coming to London, to interview him. And in contrast to the other four, the other historians, Hobsbawm, Hilton, and Thompson, he actually said, you shouldn't interview me. He said, you should treat me like, and this is an American historian who was famous for the frontier thesis, and he taught out here in Wisconsin a good part of his career, and then I think Yale for the rest of it. He said, you should treat me like Frederick Jackson Turner. You should treat me as dead, not as a moving target, that kind of thing. And so he actually didn't see, he essentially refused to see me when I was working on the book project. And it was only later when Christopher Hill and another one of the really significant British Marxist historians, George Roudet, both told him, you really do need to talk to Harvey Kay. And this is well after the book had come out. And Eric actually said, next time you contact me, next time you're in London, I'm taking you to lunch. I feel terrible that I had to be pushed by two of my longtime comrades to do this. Okay, but that's not, the other thing I wanted to say is this. Those words that you read, Robert, it's interesting because another one of the British Marxists, not a historian, but a professor, I guess he was a professor of literature and communications at Cambridge University, Raymond Williams, a major figure, major figure. He and Hobsbawm had both begun their university as undergraduates at Cambridge. I guess it would have been around 1939, 1940, but both ended up going into the military in World War II. And so after the war, they both returned to Cambridge and both were members, of the Communist Party. And they must have entered into these conversations about words and stayed in touch on that because Raymond Williams opens his book, The Long Revolution, also talking about words. And later he published a really fascinating collection, like a glossary, not a glossary, but it was a group of essays on what he called keywords. So it would be, I wish I had realized that when I was talking to Hobsbawm, I would have liked to have known how it was that he and Williams, who were parallel in many ways, though different fields, both begin what really becomes their first major books in, that reached out beyond the specifics of their disciplines. Anyhow, it was interesting to hear you say that, Robert, because.
Yeah, I mentioned on a show either last week or the week before that the renowned British avant-garde documentarian Adam Curtis has come out with a new sort of history of Thatcherite England, the end of the 20th century. It's a lot of clips. It's very sort of avant-garde and dark. I don't know if you're familiar with Curtis's work, but one of the clips in one of the early episodes is a clip of Hobsbawm in the 60s giving a lecture on the Age of Revolutions, and he's talking about the invention of these words to describe the things that were happening, and how a myth developed around these words, which is sort of the point. The larger scope of Curtis's documentary is that a lot of it, comes with myth making and sort of how things are made up. And so I went back, and I think we were talking. I was just traveling last week, and read Age of Revolutions, and yeah, it just struck me that it would be something we could talk about. But it's also very interesting given our current events.
Yeah. It's, I actually developed, in response to Raymond Williams' work, a course for, I think it was sophomore students, called Keywords. And they bought this book, which was not easy for them because they were American 19-year-olds. And his book is written by a Cambridge professor with the idea of a British audience in mind. And then and it's quite possible. I won't claim that I did it. I'll just say it's possible. I might well have had them read the first section of The Age of Revolution by Hobsbawm. The point is that I was really excited when you said you were reading that out on, can I say where you were? I guess you're out.
Yes, we're on in the high desert of Montana.
Right, yeah. And I think I told you the photograph you sent me of that just reminded me, even though it wasn't filmed in Montana, of the television series Longmire, which, by the way, is always available, I believe, in repeats. And if people can watch it, I really think it's a phenomenal series. Anyhow, so it just was exactly what I imagined. What'd you call it? The high desert of
High
Montana?
desert. Yeah,
High
yeah.
desert.
Well, let's get to the current moment, because we are seeing traction in the leftist political project across the country, with Mamdani, with Plattner in Maine. I know Dr. El Sayed in Michigan has been on the scene before, but seems to have, grown and is still there. And I know you're working with several candidates too, basically around the same common platform, about the 21st century Economic Bill of Rights, about, as Mamdani would say, stuff's too expensive, you can't live where you're from, and we need to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, okay. Just so people understand the reference you just made to people I've been working with, people should know that I did work very closely. I think of myself as having been her primary historical slash intellectual advisor. That is Nina Turner in her second campaign, ill-fated campaign for Congress in the Cleveland area, and she had contacted me because she saw a video that I did with the then Gravel Institute on FDR's Economic Bill of Rights and what the possibilities for us would be if we could revive that vision. And she ran on it, and I can tell you that had she won, I'd be in DC now. I would have gone with her. She really got the idea. It was phenomenal. And then I also was a primary advisor. I do these unpaid, by the way. People should know that. I want to be able to say no to people when they're asking me questions.
Harvey's already independently wealthy. We don't have to worry about that.
I'm rich in many ways, but not money. Okay, so anyhow, and I worked with very closely with Marianne Williamson, as you know. Okay, and she why? Because she decided to embrace FDR's vision and the 21st century version that Alan Minsky and I have put together of an economic bill of rights. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party didn't even allow her space in the public realm to, you know, they told pretty much told CNN and MSNBC don't have her on. And I can, and I don't have the literal proof of that, but it's obvious since Marianne was the only one of the candidates during the campaign to not receive the opportunity for a CNN town hall. And she had a bigger following than I forget the name of the guy from Minnesota who was running, a rather centrist Democrat. What was his name? Do you remember?
Dean
Is
Phillips.
it, was that?
Dean Phillips.
Dean Phillips, thank you, exactly. I mean, she had a much bigger following across the nation than Dean Phillips is my recollection. In fact, I know that was the case. So anyhow, more recently, currently, in fact, and there were some other people. By the way, somebody who wasn't very far from you in Delaware, a fellow who was running for Congress in Maryland, down towards D.C., who's been a lawyer with the airline flight attendants. I was advising him. He was in a primary with four or five other people, and he did respectably. But it was tough to try to overcome the Democratic establishment. He was running on the Economic Bill of Rights. But today, these in this season, this early season for announcing one's campaign ambitions, I'm working with Hartzell Gray, okay, who is a young guy. He's probably 31 years old. Now, in fact, next week I'll be at his wedding in Kansas City. But he down in Kansas City area, he is running for Congress in a decidedly Democratic district that the Republican MAGA types in Missouri are doing their damnedest to try to redistrict. You know, they're trying to pull one of those st the stunt that the Texans pulled. And he's running, and he is decidedly embracing an economic bill of rights vision. He's been very active in public radio and commercial radio for some years as a 20-year-old in the Kansas City area. So he's a known figure, and very much an activist, especially with the tenants' rights and tenants' reform organization down there. So he's running, and I'm advising him, though he may well be beyond the need for my help because he was so embracing of it that he probably doesn't need my conversation too often. And then a young fellow out on Long Island in New York State who is running for Congress. And I say young because I'm not sure he's exactly 26 yet, but he will be 26 on time to be a part of the campaign. Law student Lucas Venturis is running on Long Island for a congressional seat. So there are things percolating. Here in Wisconsin, I've had no contact with her, but Rebecca Cook is running as a young working class person, I think probably out of farming in the western part of the state. And a lot of these people are responding to the moment. And what is the moment? I mean, we'll talk more about this. The moment is that democracy is not just in crisis, it's under siege. That's one. Two, the siege isn't simply Trump. The siege is the Republican Party, which, as you know, I've been saying for 50 years, I've written articles about this. For 50 years, we've lived through not creeping socialism, as the right would like to claim, going all the way back to Reagan and his assertions, but through a 50-year period of creeping authoritarianism. Another way that I like to put it, in fact, I prefer putting it more often, is we've been experiencing 50 years of class war. And it's gotten to the point probably where we're at the precipice. You know, we either rediscover who we are as Americans and the struggle for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or we just, you know, we just fall into the abyss. So these things are happening. I mean, there are others we could talk about around the country. I don't know much about them yet, but the two you mentioned to me when you said, should we talk about Mamdani? Decidedly, Mamdani is an extremely attractive figure, and the Democrats have a lot to learn from him. And the other fellow up in Maine, Plattner, is fascinating. He's got a bigger challenge now, I think, than even Mamdani, because Mamdani has won the Democratic nomination for mayor, which is coming up this autumn as a vote, as an election. We'll come back to that. And then, but in Plattner's case, he's early in, but there are a lot of other folks who are being entertained by the Democratic Party, one of whom One of them, I understand, is in her 80s, and as a
Yeah,
matter of fact,
the governor of Maine, who I guess was going to announce in the wintertime or maybe the beginning of next year, is 78, I think. Is that something like that?
I guess maybe I made her older than she is, but you've got the idea. She's
Well, she would be 70. Maybe she'd be 79 or 80 when she would take office, potentially.
yeah, something like that. Let me be honest with everyone. I'm 75, so I don't like to hear people attacked for their age, I can tell you. But it is the case that the Democratic Party has looked for too long, okay, been dominated by folks who are not simply stuck in a certain age, they're stuck in a certain historical age, okay? They're still stuck in the last 50 years of a time in which the Democratic Party abandoned the FDR, the truly progressive, in fact, social democratic tradition, and turned their backs on the working class. And those folks still seem to be stuck there. I mean, the Democratic Party is all but dead right now, okay? And their only hope is the fact that people are so outraged by what's going on with in the wake of the big, beautiful bill and other kinds of nastiness, that they're prepared to vote against Trump and maybe a host of MAGA figures around the country. That's the Democrats are holding out for. Well, that's not enough. Sorry, I'm getting revved up doing this.
Well, I mean, that's frankly, it should be fairly obvious that the takeaways, the basic sort of top line takeaways that I take from this whole thing is that number one, it hasn't been enough because they've been relying on that now for 8 years. Trump has run in three elections, won two. And the idea was just like, just don't vote for whatever else other than that. That doesn't work. That's
By the
number
way,
one.
you're younger than I am, so I will make this point again. They've been running on that idea ever since 1976, when the Democrats were relying on the fact that Americans did not want a Republican in the wake of Watergate. Okay.
Yeah, it's an old
Then,
strategy.
yeah, then they when they lost in 1980 to Reagan, they then ran pretty much on the fact that Reagan recession ensued, and they were saying, "Well, we can win this time. We don't have to become progressive or liberal in a fighting sense, or what I prefer, either let's call it social democracy." They think, "Well, we can win because, basically speaking, Reagan brought a recession, right?" Well, I mean, so they figure we'll win because the Republicans are the party that brings what? Recession, okay, deepening exploitation, attacks on working class life. Well, it's not enough. It's
Yep.
not enough. And
And
my proof
again,
of that is that Mondale's most famous in that campaign in 84 for he won't tell you, but I will. We will raise your taxes. Okay, yeah, we have to raise your taxes. I mean, that's a hell of a way to run, right? Right? And then you've got the technocrat, Dukakis. And then you've got Clinton, who literally was, I mean, as he was in the wake of the Carter precedent, he was Mr. Neoliberal. I mean, the 1990s, right? 1990s with Clinton, we could lay out the degree to which the Democrats didn't just turn their backs on the working class, but literally, can I say, fucked the working
you
class.
can say that. Yeah, it is weird. The more time that goes by when people think about Clinton, the worse it gets. Like I said, that the Adam Curtis documentary about the end of the 20th century in Britain, is focused on Thatcher and the myths and the reaction and all of that stuff and the hard line they took on the economic standpoint. But then you think, well, she correlates with Reagan here, but then Clinton basically did the same stuff. It all sort of overlapped into one big neoliberal mess, that sort of transcended party at that point. And it's interesting because at the end of the Curtis documentary, you see a backlash in Britain. You see a Labour government take over that is just as neoliberal. Privatization continues, austerity
Blair and
continues.
Clinton were like, they might as well
Yeah.
have gotten married, you might say.
I'm interested in your thoughts about how some of these candidates in specific places, and you probably have specific thoughts about it because you're working with somebody in Kansas City, a sort of an urban Midwestern area, and Long Island, which is generally a reactionary sort of place. how and Mamdani himself has sort of taken the idea of an economic bill of rights, but has made it specific in strategy toward New Yorkers, towards taking the bus, towards the bodega, towards the halal cart,
Key word is affordability for him.
Correct. Affordability for the stuff that regular New Yorkers do, whether it's your rent or taking the bus or getting a halal at the cart or whatever it is. And then he has been able to sort of take that and make it his own, which I think that's the important step that I think a lot of, at least in the political realm, have been missing about sort of the ideas of Roosevelt, the ideas of an economic bill of rights building on this. You kind of have to make it your own and make it resonate with your constituency wherever you happen to be. And it's not going to be the same in New York City as it's going to be in Long Island, as it's going to be in Kansas City, or as it's going to be in Maine.
Yeah, of course, the affordability question may well work in parts of Long Island because of the fact that, as New York, as wealthier folks are moving out. I mean, well, hell, Long Island had plenty of wealthy communities, the North Shore of Long Island, Montauk, I mean, the Hamptons, and so on. But there are a lot of working people out there who really do have to confront the question of, how am I going to pay for my kid going to college? How am I going to pay for the taxes that I'm being asked to pay, that aren't necessarily going to the public services that I think we need. It's that, all those things come into play. Well, look, so the groundwork for all this, of course, and let's start with New York. Let's start with New York. Okay. And let me be clear to everyone. I said my older daughter lives down in St. Louis with her family. My younger daughter and her husband live in Brooklyn. Okay. In a area called Greenpoint. And I'll also make it clear that my daughter is very high up in Letitia James, Attorney General's office. My daughter heads the department or the bureau which enforces labor law. Okay.
Yeah, well, so I guess that's kind of got to pass down that through the genealogy. Very good.
Yeah, I'm proud of both girls. One's an architect, the other's a lawyer, and I'm thrilled by the work she's doing. I mean, they won some really great cases, like, what is it? What's Uber's? Is it DoorDash? Is that Uber? The DoorDash folks, the ones who deliver the food quickly
Yes.
in
Yep.
order. Yeah, well, they won the case against DoorDash for basically cheating workers of their monies, of their entitlements. For what they've done, the work entitlements. It was a huge settlement. And those are the kind of things that I love to see. Anyhow, to come back. So they live in Brooklyn. And so I'm originally from the New York area. So and like any other American, I have an interest in the biggest city in the United States. If LA has passed that, I apologize to Los Angeles, but
Never apologize to West Coasters. We don't have
thank
that. We
you.
never have to
Thank you.
apologize.
Thank
West
you.
Coast, get out of here.
Thank you. I'm with you on that. Okay. Anyhow, and I was talking to them quite a bit this past summer, both by FaceTime and otherwise. And I was amazed by their enthusiasm and the warm embrace that they had for Mamdani. By the way, they also liked, is his first name Doug? Did you follow it closely? Doug Lander?
Yeah, he's the guy, I guess, in this who actually cr they cross endorsed each other. I guess Doug
Right.
Lander will be the comptroller of the city
He is
under in a
yeah, he has been the comptroller. The
or he
question
is the comptroller.
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
The big question is this: will he become deputy, one of, I think there are two deputy mayors, I'm not sure. Will he
Yeah,
become
that's it.
mayor, or will he run for Congress himself? And I mean, I like the guy a lot, okay? I mean, I really do. And I thought, in fact, the beauty of their alliance is something that Mamdani needs to carry into his mayoral administration. That capacity to create alliances is going to be really crucial, in quotes, when he wins, because I'm hoping it's real, in November. Okay, he's going to have to learn how to create alliances. That's absolutely crucial. Or sustain alliances is another way of putting it. Anyhow, so look, Mamdani himself comes out of New York politics. He's a assemblyman, right? In the New York Assembly.
Yes. Yep.
And I mean, he knows damn well the needs of New Yorkers. I mean, It's a and by the way, let's be clear, who he had an, he did have an advantage, which became very clear to me every time I was in New York talking to people. Number one, Eric Adams may have a following, but his the record of corruption that surrounds him has really placed a smell about him. Okay, I mean, even
I mean, every corrupt sort of politician is going to have a circle of sort of hangers-on because some of that money falls out of pockets and falls to you if you're sort of in the area. So
right.
it's not uncommon for a corrupt person to have, a van of supporters ready to roll, but that doesn't necessarily get you anywhere.
Yeah, and by the way, it seems so appropriate that Trump is apparently trying to offer him a place in the administration if he will step down for if he will give up his campaign.
Harvey, you know what we say? New York is the Riyadh of America. Did you know
Oh.
that? You know that's the Eric Adams thing where New York is the Istanbul of America, New York is the
Oh,
Mexico City of America. He's the big
sorry, right. I get you now. You bet. I do get you. Yeah. Sorry. Otherwise, it went over my head. It was
No
my,
worries.
I've been in Wisconsin long enough. I also have a certain element of naivete.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's one. And then Cuomo, I mean, Cuomo, of course, has a significant following, but he too has an incredible stink about him. Okay. I mean, really remarkable stink. And he also carries a record from when he was. You know, he's postured as if he was going to really do something, you know, to protect New Yorkers in during COVID, right? And he really postured amazingly. Meanwhile, he was in the process of shutting down hospitals as part of his administration's, budget cut, effort to cut budgets. I mean, both those men, okay, how anyone could overlook baggage that they carry is amazing. But so here was my daughter and my son-in-law. Just absolutely enthusiastic. Not to mention the fact that Mamdani is young enough, okay, he's not identified with the elite and the establishment. And he carries, he learned a lot from Bernie, okay, from Bernie Sanders. In fact, in interviews, he makes clear the debt that he owes to, in his political imagination, to Bernie's campaigns. And young people responded, which, by the way, is really remarkable because I'm not sure if Bernie's old enough to be his grandfather. But it's one of the things I could never get over during the race of 2016 and then 2020 when Bernie was running, was that his following was so vast amongst young people. Okay, we used to have to ask myself, how is it that the grandfather has all of a sudden become, the godlike figure to these people? You know, the enthusiasm for this guy. And the only way you could put it, perhaps, was that the parents' generation had so disappointed them that they looked beyond that, to Bernie.
Yeah, I really think. I mean, one of the things you hear the Democratic apparatus, and a story came out just last week about, trying to infiltrate the independent media sphere and do this and that, because it's not real. But the problem is that it's not really about it's about the message. We've had of the politicians who have made any inroads and gain traction being connected to the Bernie Sanders program or his what some one of his campaigns or the fight oligarchy sort of tour that they're doing. It's all different kinds of people, so it is more the message than the packaging. It's not just the messaging or how it sounds or what words you use. It's really what it is. So it doesn't matter if you're a young black woman or a trans native man or a very old Jewish man from Vermont. If people like the ideas, maybe they'll gain traction.
Yeah, and in that vein, let me put it this way. I'll remind everyone, I probably said it before when we've done shows together, that Bernie would have won in 2016 and he would have won in 2020. Okay. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind about that because the fact is that people were yearning for an alternative to the Democratic establishment. And the choice they were ultimately given because the Democratic establishment was so effective in crushing Bernie in 2016 was Trump or Clinton. And Clinton, everyone knew Clinton was the redemption of the first Clinton administration. I mean, when she rejected the idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage, That should have been obvious. When she rejected the idea of Medicare for all, it should have been obvious. I mean, she was a neoliberal, period. Okay. And people didn't want a neoliberal. I know she got more votes in the popular form, but the point is she lost my state, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and lost the election because people knew that they'd had been screwed by NAFTA. They'd been screwed by the end of aid to family with dependent children. They were screwed by the first Clinton, okay, here in these states. Why would they want to be screwed by a second Clinton?
Completely
Right.
agree.
So you, well, I'm with you. I agree. Now, Mamdani's messaging has been great, but the content of the message is more important, has what been the draw, as you said. In fact, if you, I don't think you probably bothered to look, but I was looking at what people had to say, you know, what the Clinton young folk, I what, you know, I mean, the Pod Save America types, okay, what they were saying in the wake of Mamdani's victory. Right, basically, those kinds of folks, maybe even MSNBC. I never watch MSNBC, so I can't tell you. They were talking about the packaging as opposed to the package. They were saying exactly that it had to do with his, you know, media savvy in terms of the of YouTube and social media and so on. And bullshit. It's true. Okay, but he would never have picked up the kind of following he did if it wasn't for the fact that he was talking exactly to the point. And all across America, people want to be, they want to vote for someone who really will make a difference. It's amazing how many people voted for Trump thinking he would make the difference. How they could buy into his lies and his bullshit is beyond me, but they did. Okay. And it's the, what, and what Mamdani is saying is we're going to make New York City affordable. Right. I mean, plus, it is, it's great. I was just watched a video earlier. Did you ever see this video he did on the Staten Island Ferry?
Yes.
That was clever as could be. Okay. He said the Staten Island Ferry is free and everyone loves the Staten Island Ferry. Well, we can do it here in New York. Okay. We can make transit free.
Yeah. There is one issue that kind of is sort of the elephant in the room here, because we've seen it affect the national elections the last time with Kamala Harris. And we see it affecting these sort of Democratic Party fights now. It's certainly part of Mamdani, and it's certainly part of the main race that has begun.
You're going to war on Gaza, right?
Of course, of course.
Right.
And I know this is not something that you normally discuss.
Well,
I know
something I
it's
don't
not
normally
you.
discuss, but it is the case that the brutality, okay, the mass murder, okay. I mean, Americans see it and they understand it.
And I'm not going to put up with it anymore, I don't think.
And well, at least young people are not going to do
Yes,
it.
at least the
Now,
people in this cohort are
okay.
not.
I
Yeah.
mean, I you know, I've learned not to assume that all Americans think alike. Okay, that all I mean, I've, it's beyond. It's not that, but in key constituencies, it's clear people do not want pay for the bombing of Palestinians in Gaza. Period. It's as simple as that. Okay.
Yeah, and I think people have to be on people candidates of this ilk that we're discussing, who are going to bring a working class message to regular people about their lives, whether it's housing, transportation, healthcare, education, whatever. The Bernie sort of the Bernie program for the 21st century with energetic people who know how to do social media and all of that stuff. All of those people are going to have to be unequivocally against apartheid and genocide by Israel. And it's not just Gaza, unfortunately. I mean, all the settlements continue at pace.
Yeah,
Journalists are being killed in the West Bank.
the violence that's being perpetrated, and the violence includes both the stealing of the taking of lands and the attacks by settlers on Palestinians. I mean, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's absolutely amazing that it's gone on this long, and that the American government and the primary figures in the American government found it themselves utterly incapable of saying stop, and you know, and figuring out a way to make it stop. And it's just, that's all I can say. I can't speak beyond that because there's nothing more I could imagine saying.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. Well, I'd like to change gears a little bit right now and get your get your feeling on a new essay that we've published in the Delaware Call on something that you have context in, the American labor movement. As we talk about Carl's new essay, The Chicken Wars, the history, a brief history of the labor movement and the chicken industry in Delaware.
Well, they blew up the chicken man in Philly last night, and they blew up his house too.
I first want to congratulate Carl because it's another great essay about a specific issue in Delaware that I think is not really well fleshed out. And I suspect that, and this is might be news to Harvey as well, this came out of other research you're doing, because Carl has endeavored to write his first book on the history of what they call the Delaware Way, or sort of deal-making centrist politics in Delaware that started around the 70s, around the neoliberal time period. But in doing that, he's done all kinds of other research. So I just want to congratulate him on another banger for the Delaware Call, The Chicken Wars.
Yeah, in fact, and I want to second that. I, having read the piece earlier this afternoon, I the writing is so clean and so fine that it made an understanding of what was going on there that much easier, even for me this far away from Delaware, okay? I mean, it really is a great piece, and it's yet another reminder, okay, of, well, we'll get to it, of the failure of the Democratic Party to make working people's lives less oppressive.
Yeah. Hey, Carl, so the whole thing started with a typical Delaware, in typical Delaware fashion, by mistake, which I did not know that the chicken industry, because it's one of our, you know, big agricultural industries. Yeah, it's one of our big ones. And it's funny because if you go back, we read a book, and I forget the woman's name who wrote it, but wrote a great history of Delaware prior to the Civil War, so antebellum sort of Delaware through slavery and Reconstruction. And one of the stories in that is that Delaware in colonial times did have a tobacco industry, but it sort of fell off and was sort of like second rate. And so this story sort of starts off with the farmers of Sussex County looking for something else because it's just not working. And Carl, maybe you can take it from there.
Yeah, and I think it was Patience Essa, I believe. I forget.
Yeah, Patience Essa, that's right.
But yeah, House Divided, great book. Quakers and Churchmen.
That's right.
But yeah, so with Sussex County, yeah, it'd always been agricultural. And then, you know, this is not stuff that I've done deep, deep research into, but basically throughout the last bit of the 19th century, the big thing was railroads. So, you know, they started building railroads after the Civil War down into Sussex County, which had a lot of like weird internecine conflicts around, like, you know, the stuff that everybody was mad about, like railroad rates and like, oh, you're charging this much for this many crops, but then you're charging that much for this many crops, which is like the whole reason the populist movement existed. But in classic Delaware fashion, we did not really have a Delaware Farmers Alliance. I only found one piece of evidence that there ever was anything called that. But
wow.
So yeah, we didn't really have a lot of, you know, it created a division between the Democrats and the Republicans in Sussex, but not much else. But yeah, by the turn of the century, Sussex County agriculture was just not doing particularly great. You had a few people that made a lot of money on things like peaches and strawberries. But, you know, the average farmer was not doing amazing, especially by the like 1920s. But yeah, so the legend goes.
Yep. And just for the record, agriculture in the 1920s was nationally. Yeah. Like a recession, you might say, at least
In
terms of the incomes of the farmers.
Yeah. So as legend goes, as I put it, because I don't entirely believe this story.
Seems apocryphal in some sense.
It seems very apocryphal, especially given the fact that the woman's husband ended up being the Senate pro tem. Like, it kind of seems like, you know, maybe you just kind of made the story up after the fact to like give a fun story. But all the proper sources say that this is what happened. So, you know, I kind of go with it, which is, yeah, Cecile Steele, who at the time her husband was like a, like in the Coast Guard or something, but she is going to buy some chickens to lay eggs, and she orders 50, gets 500, and it's like, well, I guess I'll just sell these chickens, or I'll just raise them and actually sell them to meat. And then she gets like a good price on it, and so she's like, oh, this is a really good idea. A lot of other people see they're looking for something to do. They already most of them have some sort of chicken flock already because it's farms, you know. A lot of people raise.
Everybody has chickens. Come
Everybody
on.
has chickens at the time, yeah. And so yeah, then you just have this industry pop up overnight. So it initially starts with you get obviously people raising the chickens, growing the chickens, and then you have the feed industry pops up, and then trucking as well. So you just had what is now Route 113 and Route 13 had just been finished in the early 1920s, and so you're able to drive all the chickens up to Philadelphia or to New York or whatever, and they get slaughtered there, and you make your money. So by the like near the end of the Great Depression, beginning part of the World War II, you start to see all these chicken plants pop up, and that's like basically the ones that we have down in Sussex County in the Eastern Shore now. Most of those got their start in the late 1930s, early 1940s, and they start out pretty technologically rudimentary, but then you know over time they get more and more well-oiled. But yeah, now most of these chicken plants are staffed by like largely Hispanic immigrants. A lot of them are undocumented. But at the time, because it was Sussex County, you had this legacy of slavery there. So you had a lot of like very poor and working class black people. And a lot of them are the ones who end up working at these chicken plants. And so, yeah, so suddenly overnight, because Sussex had been entirely agricultural, but by the 1940s, you got the chicken plants. And then I don't write about it all, but you know, another thing kind of shaking up the environment is, DuPont built their nylon plant there starting in 1939. So suddenly within basically like 15 years, Sussex County goes from 100% agricultural to having like these pretty major industries.
You can imagine how successful nylon industry would be during World War II.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It really took off overnight. I forget what the nickname people gave for Seaford where it got built. It was like Cinderella City overnight, because it's overnight it goes
Yeah.
becomes this big thing. Which of course, like many other things, the nylon plant shut down like 10, 15, or like 15, 20 years ago. Or
Yeah, so this is about the time when the works start to when mechanization comes in, there's centralization and capital interests are basically fueling the centralization and acquisition of some of the smaller farms, and it went from sort of the small proprietor raising animals, potentially sending somewhere else to be processed, but into larger sort of corporate conglomerates, and this is where the story really kicks off.
Yeah, so by the 1940s, you got these corporate conglomerates. And also, I couldn't find the exact year because a lot of the things are not super well documented, obviously, because, you know, the main papers we had in Delaware were, I mean, they're both the News Journal, but every evening, or it might have been the News Journal at that point, and the Morning News, both of which are owned by the DuPonts. So these are not exactly pro-labor, interested in covering the like ins and outs of like poor and oppressed workers and like what they're up to. So by 1945, it seems that the AFL has sort of like gotten involved in the chicken industry, which makes sense, you know, with the war. One of the things I also did not put in there is that during World War II, we brought German POWs to Sussex County and they worked in the chicken plants.
Yeah.
So they had basically slave labor of German POWs, which, you know, these are Nazis, so I'm not exactly super sympathetic, but kind of just a weird aside in the chicken industry. But they eventually went back to just using poor black people. But yeah, so AFL gets in there. So it's the Amalgamated Meat Cutters. So these are mostly people who had been organizing butchers and packing house workers earlier on in the century. But they get their stake in there. And then the Teamsters, of course, managed to start organizing a lot of the truckers. And the Teamsters, maybe I'll write about it at one point. They seem to be the only ones who did a successful strike in Delaware, because I've written about three different strikes and none of them really ended particularly well. But the Teamsters in 1936 in Wilmington had a big strike where they basically doubled their wages because they shut down Wilmington's entire transportation network.
Can I ask questions along the way?
Yeah,
Of
yeah.
course. So the chicken workers, the ones who are they're predominantly at this point in time, we're talking like 40s and well 30 well 30s but it's 40s and 50s are black. And the Teamsters probably were white, but I don't
I
know
think for the
for
most part, because just based on the pictures I saw, because it doesn't get covered. It took a little while to even notice in the newspaper reports that they were like, most of the strikers were black, or
yeah.
it's not the
So,
word.
to what, and so I wonder to what extent strikes fail because the larger white pop, the white population just has very little sympathy.
Well, that's the, I mean,
I think
that was
that's
the
a very
shocking thing of this story, right? Is this like it turns, the labor issue turns on a racial sort of dynamic and authoritarian issue very obviously, and I think that that's exactly right. I mean, the person reading the news journal in Wilmington really has no sympathy or thought for a poor black worker in Sussex. I think, I mean, that's the point. That's what I got just from the piece. And I know, Carl, you read a lot more deeply sort of into the minutiae of these fights there.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a lot.
another question, because
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not a Delaware person, and my experience in Delaware is basically driving over from Jersey on the Delaware Memorial Bridge and making my way to DC. But here's my question. At what point did the DuPont chemical industries get organized, or did they fail to get organized?
They never really got properly organized. So essentially by the 1960s, so there's the old Ralph Nader report, the company state. And that's where that's my information from. So there's probably more to it that I have not looked into yet. But basically, they had independent unions that represented the DuPonts, like the DuPonts. So they had like, so none of the white collar workers that were organized. And then at the various like chemical plants, they had independent unions that were not affiliated with any like
Yeah,
chemical
and
unions.
those are
And I
often cut
don't get
by,
the sense that they were quite company unions, but they were the next step up from company unions.
yeah, they probably were close to company unions. And the reason I say, so here's a question. This is one something I failed to do when I was working on the work on FDR and the Greatest Generation and labor, which is central to all of that. Especially during the 30s, there were the great sit-down strike at Flint and so on. The guys who owned General Motors, did that include the DuPont of Delaware? Yes.
DuPont were controlling owners for a period of time for GM. I think
Right.
actually
And this
during
is
the time.
especially during this period. Yes. And I mean, these were the richest men in America. I say men because they were a bunch of
Oh, yeah.
men. Okay, richest men in America. And they were prepared to do anything necessary to make sure the automobile industry, the UAW, did not organize General Motors. Okay. And fortunately, there was a governor in Michigan, Frank Murphy, okay, who would eventually become attorney general and a member of the Supreme Court. And he was close to FDR, and he called out the National Guard to protect the workers during that strike. And the reason this comes up is that if DuPont is part of that scene by way of his shares in General Motors, then I'm sure that he was running a police state inside of his chemical plants in Delaware.
Yeah, they
Okay.
had a pretty notable private army that they used to do internal security.
Yeah. Robert La Follette Jr., who was senator from Wisconsin in the 30s, I don't know if you know, he had launched a national inquiry, a committee that he took around the country, and he revealed the arsenals that the big capitalists had accumulated in their plants, prepared to literally gun down any union effort that might threaten their control over the plants. It was a huge ex series of exposés that came out, but I don't know if we ever got to Delaware
Yeah.
in that.
Well, because in Delaware, and that's sort of what happened here, is that they like to do more. Everything's always a little bit tidier in Delaware. It's always a little bit
Yeah.
nicer.
That's why with
Means that it's
their
better.
That's why if there were independent unions at the time, I can assure you they were, if they were not company unions, they were decidedly kissing cousins of
Oh,
company
yes. Yeah.
unions.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the DuPont, yeah, their whole thing was no unions ever. Like, yeah, whether it's GM with DuPont, yeah, not big fans.
Right.
Yeah, and there is a you mentioned the governor of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, our state government, Governor of Michigan, pardon me, yes. unfortunately, our state government has been generally reactionary pretty much the whole time. I mean, you brought up earlier, I don't know if we had turned the microphones on yet or not, but the fact that Delaware was a slave state. It was a border state because we didn't secede, but there was slavery all over, even in New Castle County. Not much, but you know, there was. And yeah, there was only, I think, if and again, going back to the Essa book, A House Divided, Delaware, Antebellum, and Slavery, I point people to that book because, yes, while there weren't large plantations in Delaware, because there was slavery at large farms and small farms too, and house work help or house slaves, unfortunately, some of those got shipped to or sold to or kidnapped to. We have a very famous story of a woman who ran a gang kidnapping people and selling them to the Deep South, to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. So, yeah, our history with that is very bad. And because we were part of a movement that didn't secede and just did the border state thing, this sort of like tightrope walk has gone into the 20th and 21st century of like, well, we weren't as bad as, or we're not as bad as, and because it's small, it's able to be controlled. And, you know, they're all of the hallmarks for people who are, have been reading the Delaware Call or reading Carl's work. All of the hallmarks are there for classic Delaware way stuff. Carl, do you want to give us, let's go back to the story. Yeah, because there's a character in it that's classic Delaware way, and there's some interesting sort of fights that you might want to touch on and some strikes. So I want to give you the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I assume you're referring to Homer Pepper.
Homer Pepper. I mean, what a name.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah,
so Homer Pepper, took the pepper right out of my mouth.
So he comes from like a longtime Sussex County family, as far as I can tell.
This is the guy who, am I mistaken? Is he the guy who left his wife and something?
Yes. So I was trying to figure out, like, okay, I was going through newspapers and just seeing like, okay, what did this guy do before? And so he got involved in the chicken industry as a teenager. And yeah, I just kept finding stories of him running off on his wife and getting into car accidents. So he was like living quite the life in his 20s. Seems that he calmed down afterwards.
Was he a drunk driver when he got in the accidents?
They had no way of measuring at the time, but I kind of got the sense based on how some of them played out. I didn't include too much of it in the actual story because it wasn't technically important, but I did find it funny that like the guy who ran off on his wife and got sued so bad that it made the newspaper and was like getting into accidents the whole time is still like a respected member of Sussex County society, which I feel like kind of gave, you know, kind of showed that maybe this whole respectability thing is not entirely accurate based on how they describe it.
Well, you know, power structures at a county level can be quite something. And given the possibilities of other men and or women participating in strange affairs, maybe they didn't want to go after him for that.
Yeah, so he becomes the chicken baron, basically, of Sussex County. So he, like, consolidates this. He becomes a grower. He starts a trucking company. And then he also buys and, like, becomes the main proprietor for the H&H Poultry Company, which is now the Monterre Farms processing plant in Selbyville. And as he is doing that, building that up, the CIO also now throws down in the chicken plant. So Delaware got their CIO chapter.
What year was that? I read that, but remind me.
That started in 52. Okay. The Delaware CIO started in 1937. It was mostly like shipbuilders, steel workers. UAW started in the 50s as well.
Exactly what you would expect, right?
And I have no evidence.
Just let everyone know that you're referring to CIO and AFL separately because
at that point,
ever since the mid-30s, they were separate, basically. Yep. Okay. AFL was more the trades unions. Yep. Okay, and the CIO were industrial unions.
Yes. Yes.
And so far more progressive federation.
Far more progressive, much more likely to allow black workers.
Oh, no, they actually were, in many areas, they were adamantly interracial unionism.
Yep. And so the CIO started in 1937, and then I have no evidence that this was related to Project Dignity. So after World War II, the CIO launched a big organizing campaign across the South to try to organize workers.
Yeah, Project Dixie, you said. Yeah.
Largely not successful, but around the same time they're also now getting involved in the chicken plants, and so they organized several chicken plants, including Homer Pepper's H&H Poultry Company.
And for what it's worth, the NFL had a similar effort, but nothing on the scale of the CIA.
And so the CIO actually manages to take over several chicken plants that were organized previously by the AFL Union, the Amalgamated Meat
Yeah,
Cutters.
let people know takeover doesn't mean they bought them. It means that
Oh, yeah.
they
There was an
organized them, or
election.
effectively organized them.
And so, yeah, in 1952, you have this kind of balkanized situation because all these different chicken plants are kind of owned by different companies, and they're all these workers are generally represented by different unions now, too, because there's three different unions in this chicken plant, which ironically is kind of against the idea of the CIO, where it's supposed to be wall-to-wall industrial unionism. But some plants, it's the AFL represents them, and then like the Teamsters are representing the truck drivers, and then the lower class workers are represented by it. So you have this very like inconsistent and not totally, as we see in the strike itself, not necessarily super reliable union structure
Would
around.
you know if the AFL, the plants where the AFL was strong, were they also black workers?
I believe so. I could not find any evidence of that, but based on just
Because
like
that's
actual
fascinating.
tokenism.
That to me is that's fascinating.
Yeah, they were notoriously not particularly anti-racist, let's say. In many cases, they were actively pro-racist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also one would imagine the CIO could have easily sort of raided those that kind of union, given the racial question.
Yeah, and I got a sense that they had limited resources because they only ran three elections, and they won all of them. So I wonder if they just didn't have the money or the time, because the two people that were running the election, it was the president of the Delaware CIO who lived up in Wilmington. They brought a guy from New Jersey, and then the third organizer was like a local Selbyville union guy. So I think they just like probably did not have the resources to.
Yeah, it's quite possible. I mean,
It's hard to tell.
it is possible. A resource question, yes.
But so yeah, in 1953, they start negotiating their contract. They're asking for a 30-cent increase. The company says, we will give you 5 cents. And as happens in many of those cases, a strike breaks out. And so ultimately, this strike, as we talk about in the story, does not work out. And a big reason why is because the way that Sussex County handles union organizing, like as far as I could tell, nobody was killed or anything, but they have a lot of very more traditional Southern ways of dealing with this stuff. So, I mean, 2 days into the strike, that CIO organizer that we talked about, he's like at his house outside, and he sees hooded figures, or I don't know if he sees them or someone else sees them later, but there's hooded figures, and they burn a giant cross on the lawn across from his house. He has to flee to his mother's house, and they track him down there, and they don't do anything officially, but they're clearly like trying to threaten
Now,
him.
let's remind everyone, what year is this?
1953.
Yeah, I mean, this is not like a 1920s
No, yeah.
moment or late 19th century. This is 1950s.
And this is
Yeah, this
decades
is.
after the Klan was technically last active
This
in
is eight
Delaware.
years after the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And I was already born, but I was only 4 years old or 5 years old at the time. Four
Yeah,
years
and
old.
so with there actually was another Klan meeting in Delaware in 1965 in Bear, Delaware. For those who know Bear, it's a lot different now. But so the Klan was around, and it probably wasn't actually the Klan. It was probably just a bunch of people that are like, oh, we want to be like the Klan. But yeah, there was some threatening, and then in a very
They were cosplaying the Klan.
exactly, yeah. Which, to be fair, every iteration of the Klan from the original one is basically just cosplaying the previous version of the Klan. But in a very like, that's an interesting way of saying it, was the Selbyville mayor kind of makes a joke about the cross burning. It's like, oh, it wasn't even a cross, it was a V.
V for
It's like,
victory. Yeah, sure.
how did you know that, buddy? Like, sort of like, yeah, were you there at that cross burning? Because that's not an uncommon thing in the South, where most of the local power structure is involved in the racial violence. But yeah, so there was that. There was there would always be like basically a mob, so that you'd have 50 to 100 strikers outside, and then basically like a mob of townspeople would gather outside and yell at them basically and say like go back to work, yada yada. And the mob was mostly white. The strikers were mostly black. And so there somehow was not too much violence until the very end, where basically they had started arresting people en masse, and some of the strikers get worked up and started throwing stones, and a few people were beaten. I think someone might have been stabbed, but nobody was like killed, luckily. And then, yeah, sort of the final big act is someone called the fire department, and they say in the newspapers like, "Oh, of course, it was an honest mistake. Any like, who could have known what actually happened?" But basically, they called the fire department on a union meeting. And they brought in their hoses and tried to break down the door with their fire hoses to get inside of the union meeting. And basically, after that, so many people at that point had already returned to work because they clearly were being threatened, that, yeah, the strike just kind of falls apart after a couple months.
Yeah, read all about it in the Delaware Call. The Chicken War. In the early 1950s, Sussex County used small town tactics to combat an insurgent labor movement. Carl, great work.
Yeah, and just one
Yeah. Really.
last point I want to put on that, which is as a part of the broader research I'm doing, I read a lot about the 1954 desegregation case in Milford. So for those who don't know, everybody knows about like Little Rock or these more famous desegregation cases, but Milford was one of the first school districts that attempted to desegregate after Brown v. Board,
Wow.
and there was some really, once again, nobody was killed, but some really raunchy violence. So like the school board was basically put in a hiding and eventually had to be like fired by the governor, and like replaced with someone that was less pro-integration. And they burnt crosses, and there was a guy who came from DC and started a chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of White People chapter. And he held these massive rallies across Sussex County to protest against desegregation. And when I was reading about the tactics that they used to protest desegregation in Milford in 1954, it looks very similar to the tactics they used against labor organizing among black chicken workers in 1953. And so I think one of the points that I wanted to make, which is that these issues of whether it's race, labor, equal rights, whatever it is, have people having fundamental dignity that are not sort of in the traditional like good old boys of like these small rural towns. All these tactics are the same. All these like attempts to crack down on organizing all come from sort of a similar place. And ultimately, at the time they were generally pretty successful. And the reason, the most recent thing was in 2021, they managed to decertify that union that had been started back in the 1940s. And I work with some of the UFCW folks, so I don't know the full story of that organ or that campaign, but yeah, we've seen a situation, and one of the things that makes labor organizing so tough in America, which is a lot of workers live in these rural areas, and the local leadership is just sort of like homicidally opposed to labor organizing, and that's why they can never quite crack the South. That's why a lot of rural areas have become sort of dead zones for the labor movement. It makes it very tough.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because
From the
in
county.
labor history, what are seeming, look, mining communities were organizable. In places where the workers are living together and somewhat remote, other than the company goons who are running the town, organizing there is usually violent but also possible. When people are dispersed, when they're, where communications are limited, it's tough. It is tough.
Harvey, thank you so much for joining us again. I always appreciate speaking with you. Like I said, as soon as I saw Hobsbawm's picture come up in that in that film I was watching, I immediately thought of you. It's like a, you know, it's like I'm only 1 degree separated from the greatest British Princess Marxist historian ever.
You know, I really do appreciate you thinking of me, and I really appreciate you having me on. I don't know what number time this is, but I do appreciate it. I'll let you know, since I was on one time on the Economic Bill of Rights, right? With along with a state assembly. Well, was it?
Yeah, I don't remember. We did one on Economic Bill of Rights.
Or she was campaigning for office.
Oh, will this shock you? That person that you're talking about is now part of the House leadership team that has adopted centrist institutional power that the other one is now fully on board with. Here in Delaware, Harvey, sellouts abound. And I do want to show you something. Hold that thought. We remodeled the studio at the new year, and one of the things I got was this bell, this bronze turtle bell. We named this turtle Pierre Dupond, and then when something that uniquely Delaware happens, we do that. We ring the bell. And so on that note, Carrie, we see you too. I actually wish you had never been on with Harvey and you never met him. That was my mistake. I made that mistake. But we're still doing what we're doing. That's the important thing. And that was the whole sort of the point of the call was that we're still on our project. And we're going to continue to be on our project. That's not going to change. We're not going to sell out. So don't worry about that.
I have confidence. And if things should go otherwise, then I'll meet you in the middle of the Delaware Memorial Bridge. And
let us know.
Well, what I was going to tell, I mean, I've already mentioned this to you, but I want listeners to know that I was on to talk about the Economic Bill of Rights, FDR's vision of it, and the 21st century Economic Bill of Rights that Alan Minsky of Progressive Democrats of America and I put together. Well, we went beyond that. I'm optimistic, but nothing's a guarantee that we'll be signing a contract soon to write a book, a short book, to be titled The Case for an Economic Bill of Rights. And hoping to get that out. We'll never get it out on time for the 2026, but hopefully by well into the, early on in the 2028 presidential campaigns, if we still have that kind of Democratic politics, Democratic politics.
That still exists.
Yeah,
you told me one time, you know, to not get too negative or cynical, and I've always remembered that advice. So in times like this, I try to take it to heart. That's why it's always good to talk to you, and it's always good to have you on. And I was extra pleased this time that it sort of coincided with all of this work that Carl had done on a specific labor history story. And so, yeah, it was just fun. I really appreciate you joining us again, Harvey.
I know I'm keeping you beyond your bedtime, so we should go.
Well, see, you got me. You got me there.
I got you. Carl, it was great seeing you, and keep up that really good work.
Thank you. Good to see you as well.
Yeah, and you know what we say as
a... By the way, I don't get to listen to him a lot because I've got other things besides Delaware on my mind. But I will tell you, I am very impressed by the work you two are doing. Really impressed. And I feel honored to be included on these occasions.
Well, the honor is reciprocated. I'm just so happy to be able to speak with you, to get your ideas, to understand that the history that you know, not just in Wisconsin, but, you know, just in general, you know, always a pleasure to speak with you. So thanks a lot. And as we always say, as a little code word to all of our people who have been with us since from the beginning, left is best.